This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Alrighty, folks, I think everybody has got their glasses replenished now. Our second reader tonight, the last time he read here, he treated us to a thrilling rickshaw chase through a crowded market and a scene in a Chinese brothel. Now, I'm not sure whether we're going to get any of the same tonight, but you never know your luck. Can we have a warm welcome, please, from Mr. Scott Lewis?
There we go. Unfortunately, no rickshaws or brothels tonight. Don't tend to fit into our shit. Two little stories for you today. First one's an excerpt from the upcoming novel, which is now finally finished.
Great.
And just needs to be edited. Yeah, it's all right. And second's a short story I put together for a Cthulhu-based anthology. Okay. Leah groaned in disgust as the light from the passageway outside fell on her face. Cass had pulled back the curtain covering the entrance to their tiny sleeping compartment and stood with her arms folded, leaning against the frame. Are you planning to surface today? We've got a ship to get airborne. How's the head? Cass swiveled aside as a battered kepi spun like an oversized shuriken past her right ear. That peachy, huh? Well, you'd best get out of your system. We're up in an hour and a half. And I'm damned if I'm working that envelope on my lonesome. She turned and strolled off down the passageway, and Leah threw a stream of muffled curses after her, pressing her head hard into the pillow. Curing herself by osmosis seemed like a perfect solution, and she tried to push her hangover out through her forehead and into the flimsy cushion. After a few seconds of failure, she decided on another potential course of action. Bacon. Lots and lots of bacon. As she swung herself out of her bunk and dropped to the floor, she whined with general ambivalence at life, pulling down her rumpled nightshirt and shuffling along the passageway to the cramped female crew shower. Stripping off and stepping in, she pulled the chain and the pipe opened up. She screamed and leapt back out of the shower. Standing in the outer bathroom, she let loose with yet another string of invective that would make a sailor blush, mostly directed at the ice-cold water, but several aimed at the world as a whole. She climbed back in, lathered up, and braced herself for another deluge of cold. After enduring the ridiculous shower for as short a period as possible, she stepped out again, grabbed a towel, and pattered hurriedly back into her cabin, teeth chattering. Cass was leaning against the bulkhead when Leah emerged 10 minutes later. Looking good, gorgeous. The dusky redhead dodged another half-hearted swipe from her cabin mate. I told you, never mix the grape and the grain. They ran out of wine, Leah mumbled, staring at the floor as she plodded up the ladder behind Cass. And what did we learn? Pub needs more wine. Cass chuckled, pulled herself out from the hatch onto the next deck. Or you need to learn how to drink. Look at you, girl. You're barely an adult and you're written off already. The crew mess was busy when they arrived, with half a dozen crew members polishing off the remnants of a hearty breakfast. Grabbing a steaming plate of bacon, sausages, and what purported to be scrambled egg, but looked like something someone had left on the pavement last night, the two girls sat and started to eat. Cass couldn't help laughing as she watched Leah trying to force the food down her throat. Someone is feeling tender today, the other girl teased. Leah Delaney, scourge of musicians everywhere, not able to put away a fried breakfast. Never thought I'd see the day. Leah groaned. Skimble made me do it. Did you see the poor boy's face? I thought it was about to burst into tears. Cass shrugged again, spooning yet another mouthful of the dubious scrambled egg. She nodded towards the hatch as the big man stepped through. Speak of the devil. Skimble grabbed himself some breakfast and sat down next to the two girls, giving them both a flash of lacquered wooden teeth. How are we this morning? The crew boss's long, easy southern drawl sounded out of place in the raging cacophony of Leah's hangover. I'm great. Leah looks like death. Feels about as bad and smells even worse. Ow! Cass reached down to rub her shin. She kicks like a mule, too. Skimble rumbled with amusement. Looks like one as well. Leah slapped him on the arm, pushed her empty plate away. You feeling better? She fiddled with the peak of her kippy and then set it on her head, going for some fresh air. I want you up on the envelope in 15 minutes, Skimble called after her. The captain wants us to check the frames again. He's convinced one of the gas bags in compartment 4 is losing hydro. Leah slumped, knowing what was coming, and Cass laughed. You shouldn't be the smallest one on the team, small fry. Can't we put Cass inside the envelope, Skim? Maybe sew her in? Then I don't have to put up with her blathering? Preferably without a face mask? Leah gave the crew boss a plaintive expression and Cass threw a lump of half-eaten sausage at her. Cut that out. Get out there and wake yourself up, Leah, Skimble rumbled. Cass, go round up the others. Outside, 12 minutes. Leah walked down the passageway, clutching a canteen of water, sipping unhappily. Despite her greasy, protein-heavy breakfast, she still felt horrible. Stupid Cass and her constant urging for young colleagues to drink. As she entered the exit chamber, she took off the kepi, stuffed it into a jacket pocket, and shrugged into her rigging harness. Tugging on a pair of fingerless leather gloves, she closed the interior hatch, took a deep breath, and swung open the hatch again, leading onto the maintenance gantry. Even though the Belle Marie was securely tethered to a landing pinion, there was only a 30-foot drop to the ground below. Leah still couldn't help feeling a moment's apprehension. There was a light summer breeze in the air, causing the airship to bob on the mooring like a rowing boat tethered to a river jetty. She looked up at the towering shape of the envelope above her, noting the straps sewn into the thick fabric, which would provide her with a hand and toe holds as she crawled over the airship's surface. Compartment 4 was almost directly above the control car, and getting there would require her moving a good 100 feet diagonally over the envelope. She looped her maintenance satchel over her shoulder and waited for the rest of the team to arrive. Skimble turned up first, the crew boss almost bending double to get through the maintenance hatch. He was followed minutes later by the other 4 envelope monkeys, all harnessed in a similar fashion. Cass looked up at the envelope and unhooked one of her large carabiners, clipped attached to the long leather straps on her harness. As she clipped on, she gave Leah a grin. Ready for some fun and games? Unslipping her own carabiner, Leah muttered slightly. Not really. She'd still be in bed, ungodly turning to this early in the morning. Listen up, Skimble called to the team. Got plenty to do, not a whole lot of time to do it in. Leah, Cass, you've got the forward envelope. Check compartment 4 thorough-like. The captain's been on the blower again, telling me there's an issue. Whipple, Dougie, he looked up at 2 of the other crewmen. Aft section, give the thin a thorough looking at. Horse and Curtis, you 2 are with me. Mask up, get inside, start running the integrity checks. We've got less than an hour, folks, get to it. Race you to the gantry, small fry? Cass laughed as she grabbed a handhold, clipped on, and then pressed a release catch onto her other carabiner. Swinging up, she hooked onto the next strap and began pulling herself up the underhang of the envelope. Leah cursed and leapt after her, clipping on to 2 with 2 straps at once and scrabbling for a foothold. Within moments, the 2 resembled humanoid spiders scuttling over the fabric skin. Settling into a steady sequence of unclipping, swinging, and clipping, the 2 envelope monkeys made their way painstakingly over the giant gas bag. Once over the equatorial point of the balloon's curvature, life got a little bit easier, a fact which Leah was eternally grateful for as her arms were burning away from the exertion. Ahead of her, Cass looked back over her shoulder with a triumphant laugh. Come on, small fry, you're lagging! Gritting her teeth, Leah whirled her arms and legs to move faster. The last 30 feet of the envelope would be the decider, especially if Cass hit it before she did. The rhythmic clack-clack-clack of the carabiners locking around the canvas straps began to speed up, as the angle of Leah's ascent smoothed out from near vertical to 45 degrees and then to 70. Cass had already hit a point on the elliptical where she could crawl quite comfortably on hands and knees, only clipping away every other strap. The wind buffeted the 2 envelope monkeys as they raced over the canvas for the gantry that ran along the spine of the bag. Eventually the gradient was such that, in spite of the gust that tugged at her clothing, Leah felt she could make a dash for it. Using the momentum from one of her upward swings, she pulled herself into position, like a runner on starting blocks. And then she unclipped, pushed off, and made a beeline for the gantry. As her feet pounded on the airship's skin, Leah felt a sudden rush of freedom and exhilaration. The taut canvas gave slightly beneath her weight with each footfall, like running on a large, springy mattress. She soon caught up to Cass and passed her, turning to look over her shoulder as Cass yelled out, "Damn it, you sneak! That's cheating! Catch me if you can!" Leah's gloat was cut short as her foot caught in one of the canvas straps. She fell hard, and the springy surface of the canvas skin warped around her, before snapping back into shape like a trampoline. Leah found herself bouncing clear of the airship, up into the open air before coming down hard again. She scrambled to find purchase, but her fingers slid off the smooth fabric, and she found herself slipping further down the curvature of the envelope. Cass screamed something, but Leah couldn't hear her, engulfed as she was by an overwhelming panic, as the edge of the balloon rushed closer. She was on her back, falling feet first, legs desperately kicking to slow her rush towards the equator and the subsequent fall to the ground below. She reached the edge, felt herself going over, closed her eyes and threw out her hands as a final attempt to avoid plummeting to her death. This one's called Gods Old and New. Epiphyth spat as they crested the rise leading down to the Briton settlement. The Holdfast was a poor-looking place, a collection of ramshackle buildings built around a long hall, surrounded by a ragged palisade of earth and timber, perched on the edge of an ancient-looking wood. "Certainly no place for civilized men," he growled to his companion. The monk said nothing, but the corner of his mouth curled into a smile. The village must have housed a good 60 people, but there was little evidence of their existence outside the palisade. No signs of agriculture or farmland. "Hunter-gatherers. Too stupid to even learn how to plough the fields," Ethelfrith chuckled, looking again at the monk. "It still amazes me how narrow-minded you can be sometimes, my friend." The monk spoke quietly as he started down the hill. "The terrain here wouldn't lend itself to conservation. The soil's too poor, the ground's too rocky. You saw the sheep on the way here. My guess would be that these folk are shepherds, relying on animals rather than crops, and they would be kept inside the stockade rather than left free to roam." The big warrior nodded slowly, acquiescing to his companion's knowledge of such things. Ethelfrith knew more about killing Britons than he did about their living habits, after all. But even then, he had not come across a village like the one ahead of them. As they approached the stockade, the first vestiges of stench hit them. Ethelfrith wrinkled his nose. Death. Not the fresh scent of death, the good kind of death that he remembered hanging over the field at Piona, or at Broadford. No. This was older, ranker, like a corpse left mouldering in the sun. The monk seemed unperturbed, and as he continued to move towards the village, Ethelfrith put a hand on his shoulder. "Is this wise, Simon? I don't like the smell of this place. It isn't right." "Relax, my friend. Our job is to bring the word of God to the Britons, and from what I can tell, nowhere needs his love and guidance more than here." Ethelfrith frowned, looking up at the palisade. Somehow he couldn't shake the feeling it hadn't been God that had led them to this place. He remembered the night 3 weeks past, in the long hall of the village near Dunster, where they had been received and feted by one of the Briton chieftains. The chief and his carls had been hospitable, if wary of the big Anglo-Saxon amongst them. He couldn't blame them. Too much blood had been spilt between the two tribes for any of them to expect instant friendship. Chief Carl listened as Simon regaled him with tales of his god's miracles, whilst Ethelfrith shared mead and boasted with the carls. In truth, the warrior cared little for Simon's theological pattering. He knew that it was Thunor's grace that kept him alive through a decade of campaigning. But he was sworn to the monk's service, so he intended to make the most of his time away from home, and picked up another horn of wine. Several of them had already found their way down into the warrior's throat when Simon called him over. He excused himself from a game of bones that had just begun, and walked over to where Coel and the monk sat in earnest conversation. Ethelfrith turned his ear to their words just in time to catch the last vestiges of their talk. 2 weeks ago, 3 men from a nearby town went to trade with them. They never returned. It is said that the death worshippers revere the Anku, he who devours the souls of the dead. They feast on the flesh of the deceased, and their revels are visited by the blackest of spirits. The chief looked sickened, then spat into the fire. If you're looking for darkness to confront, my friend, you'll find it there. Ethelfrith couldn't help but mutter a prayer to Thunor as they walked along the palisade. The smell was stronger within the walls, and the carcass of a sheep lying in the dirt didn't assuage the warrior's conscience any. The village was a desperate sight, half-collapsed huts and wattle-and-daubed shacks, out of which gaunt faces stared at their visitors. Naked, filthy children ran to their mothers, who sheltered them behind ragged skirts. 2 men carrying battered axes barred their path, calling out in rough Bretonic. "Who are you who would come to visit us?" Simon stepped forward, removing the cross about his neck from the folds of his tunic, as he responded in their language. "I am Simon, a brother of Glastonbury Abbey, and this is my companion, Ethelfrith, son of Ethelric, of Baden. We request the hospitality of the Longhorn, the comfort of your hearth, for our journey has been long and wearisome." The villager who spoke gestured for them to follow him, and Ethelfrith fell into step behind Simon. "I don't like it here," he muttered in English. "Something foul hangs in the air. These people are wretched. Can't you see that everything's not well?" "What I see, my friend, are people who sorely need to be introduced to the love of the Almighty." Simon's voice was calm, almost dreamlike. "This is his will, and it is his guidance that has brought us here." "No, it wasn't," Ethelfrith thought. "What brought us here was the word of a half-drunk savage and your unfulfilled death wish." They followed the villager into the smoky long hall. The walls were hung with hides and animal skulls, and around them they could see the men and women of the village. Some looked at them in terror, others with loathing, while some had an intense, almost hungry look in their eyes. The men fingered weapons, axes, some rusted, battered swords, spears, and Ethelferth fancied that he saw some of the women carrying long knives as well. One in particular caught his eye, a hawkish-looking woman crouched at the back of the long hall. Their eyes met for just a second before the warrior felt uncomfortable and compelled to look away. At the end of the long hall, seated on a trestle chair far too large for his figure, sat a gaunt-looking man with a pinched face, long lank hair, and a piercing gaze. Behind him, an older man leant on a stick, wearing a tattered shift that may once have passed for white, a wicked-looking sickle hung in his belt. Above them, a truly impressive wolf skull hung from a beam. The creature's muzzle was warped, twisted, stunted in length, but easily twice as broad and thick as any Ethelferth had ever seen. The skull was also rounder, but there was no mistaking the wicked canine teeth that snarled in the flickering torchlight. "Who comes before Dungarth, chief of the Lancomi?" The old man glared first at Simon and then at Ethelferth. The monk took a knee in front of the chieftain, and Ethelferth followed. Subconsciously, his hand brushed reassuringly against the pommel of his sword. "I'm Simon, of the Glastonbury Abbey, and a missionary bringing the word of the Almighty God to those who would receive his glory," Simon began. "This is my sworn shield and companion, Ethelferth, son of Ethelric of Baden. We have come many miles to seek your hospitality, mighty Dungarth, for rumours of your hearth have spread far and wide." "I doubt that very much," said the chief, a wolfish smile breaking across his pale features. "We don't get many visitors here, but you're welcome to our hospitality, poor as it may be. It would be good to hear news from the lands to the east. Please, sit." Dungarth gestured to a place at the table, and Simon rose to his feet. Ethelferth followed as the monk sat down, watching the villagers lining the walls. "Your trophy must have been an impressive beast, my lord," Ethelferth remarked, nodding at the skull. Dungarth laughed, looked up at it with an expression, somewhere between fondness and reverence. "Yes, a gift from the ancestors. Not a trophy, but still worthy of a place in our hall. Please, let us not tarry with your refreshments." Dungarth called for food, and a ragged-looking girl brought three bowls of stew from a cauldron bubbling over the hearth fire beside the chief. The stew was greasy, with large chunks of veal mixed with root vegetables and millet. Dungarth watched with a thin smile as visitors began spooning the stew into their mouths. "You have quite the appetite, my friends. Please, eat as much as you desire. Mabina, make our guests a bed in the lodging house. Ensure they are comfortable." The hawkish-looking woman rose, walked slowly out of the long hall, stopping only to look Ethelferth in the eye once more. He met her gaze until she had walked past, and muttered under his breath, "Another prayer to Thunor." Something made him uncomfortable about her. He took another mouthful of stew, and Simon and Dungarth were talking of news from the east, of the Anglo-Saxon expansion, and the recent fall of Taunton and Glastonbury. The monk had yet to start his talk of God, but Ethelferth knew it would not be long before the missionary began attempting to bring the word of his Almighty to the lost souls of Dungarth's village. It was late afternoon when Ethelferth and Simon left the long hall and were led by Mabina to the lodging house. The wattle and daub hut was unlit, and their bedding was little more than a pile of hides thrown on the floor. Simon set down his possessions before heading back out into the village, leaving Ethelferth alone with Mabina in the hut. After a few seconds, she gripped his arm, and he tilted his head in curiosity when he saw the intensity in her eyes. "Why are you here?" The girl's question was a hiss, half whisper, half curse. "Ask the monk. It is his will, or his gods. Certainly not my choice." Ethelferth pulled his arm free. "Either way, we are here until he deems fit for us to leave." "You will not leave, Ethelferth, son of Ethelric. Not without my father's permission. I can help you escape, but you must swear to take me with you." Ethelferth laughed. "Girl, I see no need for us to escape anywhere. You have at best a handful of warriors who are worthy of concern. Simon will preach his peace, and should anything happen to us whilst under your father's hospitality, the gods can argue over his punishment however they may seem fit. Until such time as that happens, I will not be so discourteous as to offend my host by kidnapping one of his tribe." Mabina bristled, turning away. "Why do you follow the monk if not to protect him?" "I do protect him, but I am something much greater than simply being in his service. He, and to hear him tell the story of his god, saved my son's life." "And will his god save your life when the ancestors come? They already know the Unkin have arrived. and they'll be looking forward to tonight's revels. Etherfirth looked Mabina up and down, a scornful smirk running across his face. Are you Moon Touch, girl? What revels do you speak of? Are we to be feasted in your chieftain's longhorn tonight? The girl flushed red, eyes flaring with anger. Feasted? You may find that more feasting goes on than you bargain for, Etherfirth, son of Ethelric.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.